I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Stephanie Skenderis.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
stranded, the people of Baltimore are stuck without a crucial bridge after it collapsed last week. But the 21 sailors on board the ship that crashed into it are still on board, and they're stuck too.
Was it transmitted by actual transmissions? After years of investigating a condition suffered by Western diplomats, a team of journalists says it has evidence that ties Russian military intelligence to the mysterious Havana syndrome.
An URSA major problem. A California community sees a distressing rise in bear sightings. One resident tells us about her close encounter and the neighbors she says are responsible.
Found in translation. When a fried chicken chain opened in Northern Ireland, it opened up a world of shared slang between a TikToker there and her linguistic soulmates in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Dogs don't eat their own homework, as we learn from a new study that shows dogs have a knack for putting mental images to the things we tell them, and from an interview in our archives about a dog that worked like a dog to learn 1,000 words.
And telling tales out of stool. The dignity of the annual rowing race on the Thames between Cambridge and Oxford is diminished somewhat by the disturbing amounts of sewage flowing through the river. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that has suddenly lost its taste for current affairs. Days after a cargo ship rammed into a bridge in Baltimore, that ship, the Dolly, remains wedged under the wreckage. And stuck on that stuck ship are nearly 24 crew members. Officials are investigating the deadly crash. They're also making plans to free the vessel, recover the bodies of the victims trapped in the debris, and reopen the port. But this afternoon, Maryland Governor Wes Moore warned that work crews will have to be careful.
This is a steel bridge that is sitting on top of a container ship in the middle of the Patapsco River. We are talking about tons of steel that is mangled and cantilevered. We're talking about water that is so murky and so filled with debris that divers cannot see any more than a foot or two in front of them. We're talking about a situation where a portion of the bridge beneath the water has been described by Unified Command as chaotic wreckage. Every time someone goes in the water, they are taking a risk. Every time we move a piece of the structure, the situation could become even more dangerous. We have to move fast, but we cannot be careless.
Maryland Governor Wes Moore speaking earlier today. As that recovery work proceeds, the sailors on the Dolly are still on the job and still grappling with what happened. Several groups support crews at the port. Reverend Joshua Messick leads one of them, the Baltimore International Seafarers Center. We reached him in Baltimore.
Now, Joshua, we've just heard the governor describing the difficult situation and the difficult work ahead. You've seen the wreckage. What was it like to look at it?
Well, where the key bridge at one point commanded the skyline for all of southern Baltimore, now the container ship commands that same space. It's sitting there, the bridge is draped over it, and it's as if you took a chunk of highway, laid scaffolding over the top, and then just dropped it out of the sky. It has changed the face of Baltimore. It's really scarred the city.
Mm. You've been in touch with one of the sailors on the Dolly, on that ship. What is the latest you've heard from him?
The crew has been very cautious about their communication with the outside world. They have my contact information, and so I'm in touch with them via WhatsApp. I can tell you that they have all the supplies that they need, all the food. They're all safe and healthy. They're just waiting to see what's next for them.
You haven't been actually on board the ship yet, but you were able to get a package to the crew on the weekend. What did you send?
We sent some muffins that were made by a local homeschool mom. So that, more importantly, two Wi-Fi hotspots. The crew was without a reliable internet until Saturday morning when they got those two hotspots. And I was a little nervous about sending them. On the one hand, they desperately need to be in touch with their loved ones to let them know that they're safe. On the other, I was afraid of the conclusions they would come to when they saw these wild conspiracy theories that are circulating. That made me very anxious for the crew in regards to their mental well-being and their how much they would feel welcome or not here. I wrote a letter to the captain, including my contact information, that expressed my gratitude for them doing everything that they could to mitigate this tragedy and for saving untold lives by the swiftness of their actions.
Why did you want to write that letter?
Because I was concerned about some of the rhetoric I was hearing. I wanted them to know, since they hadn't heard from anyone off the ship, really, that in the eyes of most, they are heroes. It was important to me that they heard that.
And just to remind people, this crash happened after their ship lost power to the engine, the navigation equipment. And the ship then issued a Mayday call before impact, which did allow authorities to close the bridge traffic, which did save lives. Just something, some context for people to remember there. But what can you tell us about these 21 sailors?
All of them are Indian nationals, except for one. One is Sri Lankan. They are men. There are no females on as part of this crew, which is not unusual. They are men who are used to working in dangerous and lonely situations at the best of times. And now this lays on top of the hardships that they already face on a daily basis.
What do you expect their days are like on that ship right now?
Right now, they are still considered a working vessel. So the crew maintains a 24-hour watch. They are working in tandem with the Coast Guard, with the Army Corps of Engineers, the salvage company, tug companies, everyone involved in this recovery effort. They are a central part of all of this.
And as they're on that ship, and as the aftermath of what's happened unfolds, what do you think they might be thinking as they work and take part in the investigation?
As you may know, there are still four bodies that have not been recovered that are trapped under the wreckage of that site. And so that lays on top of the situation. And these seafarers feel the enormity of the situation to shoulder this experience, this trauma that they were central in, is unimaginable to me. I would imagine they feel a sense of guilt, and I am hoping to instill a sense of pride alongside that.
And we talked about public perception around them. Do you think they might be concerned about their future?
I think they are certainly concerned about their future because it's uncertain. They don't know if they will simply be repatriated, if their contracts will be completed aboard other vessels. They're not sure if they will be part of a criminal investigation or if they'll be imprisoned. These are foreign nationals in an unfamiliar land, and I would imagine that is an incredibly scary situation.
Is it possible through the course of this investigation that they might be found at fault?
I can't speak to that, I'm afraid. I don't know, but I will say in the mind of the crew, not knowing the judicial system here or the lay of the land, that is always a possibility in the back of their minds.
When do you think you'll be able to visit these sailors face-to-face? And when you do, what kind of conversations do you hope to have with them?
I was just at Unified Command here, and spoke with the Coast Guard, and I've been added to a VIP list of personnel who will be going out in the very near future. That looks like maybe tomorrow or the next day. When I get out there, my hope is to offer trauma care, but honestly, I want nothing more than to be the presence that they need at any given time.
Mm. Joshua, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Reverend Joshua Messick is the head of a support center for seafarers in Baltimore. That is where we reached him. A team of journalists say they've got evidence linking Havana syndrome to Russian spies. Havana syndrome is the name given to the unexplained symptoms, including migraines and dizziness, that have hit diplomats and families of diplomats from the U.S. and other countries, including Canada. The syndrome first made news around a pool of people who had served in Cuba, but strange and often debilitating cases have popped up elsewhere. A U.S. government report downplayed the possibility that a rival power could be involved. But now, a team from CBS News, Der Spiegel, and the Latvia-based outlet The Insider have conducted a year-long investigation. And their report suggests a connection to Russia's GRU military intelligence and something they're calling direct energy weapons. Roman Dobrohotov is the editor-in-chief of The Insider. He asked that we not disclose his exact location for security reasons.
Roman, the report features the story of a woman in Tbilisi. What happened to her?
Her story is actually very dramatic. So she wasn't even working in the embassy as many of other targets. She was wife of a diplomat. She just felt some strange feelings she never felt before. So it was like she's exploding from inside. So it's just a very, very loud noise that you hear in your head and only in your head. And she was at this moment, she was making laundry. So she stopped doing this. She went to the bathroom, starting throwing up. And when she changed the room, she felt that this strange, very loud noise that was in her head, it stopped at this moment. And right after this, she looked into her window. She can't, by the way, explain why she decided to look into the window, but she like intuitively understood that it is something that's going from the street. So she looked into the window, and she remembers that she noticed that there was a car parked there, and there was a tall, blonde man.
Well, what evidence do you have that this GRU military intelligence unit might be involved in what happened to her and to many other diplomats and their families around the world?
So we noticed that there are lots of coincidences in trips of these GRU agents to the places where Havana syndrome happens. So when we learned this, we just show the picture of the GRU agent to the victim. And she said that when I looked in this picture, I just felt sick because this person looks so much alike that intuitively makes me feel sick and worried, and I just can't control this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he's also as the person as she remembers, he's very tall, thin, blonde, and she didn't remember his face very well because it was not very close, but it looked pretty similar to her. So again, that doesn't look like a coincidence, and we know that this agent he was working for GRU, for his father, General Averyanov, who's actually head of this military unit. And we see from his phone calls, from his flights, that he was working for GRU. So this is only one of many, many coincidences that we found in our investigation. I think there are more than a dozen, actually.
Now, the Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has responded to your report today, saying, quote, "No one has ever published or expressed any convincing evidence of these unfounded accusations anywhere. Therefore, all this is nothing more than baseless, unfounded accusations by the media." How do you respond to that?
So he said that no one published any evidence. So we did publish evidence. And if he can explain the things that we are showing there with some other theory better than we, So if you can explain all these coincidences with GRU members flying in the same places where this happens, if he explains why the victims recognize these people, if he explains how it happens that people who we suspect are researching the same syndrome that is caused by this thing, if he explains also how these people who we suspect got money from the government for research of sound weapon, and we have documents and we published these documents that they researched so-called acoustic weapon. So if he can explain all these coincidences in a better way than we do, okay, we will agree with him, but he doesn't want even to comment this.
But then Mr. Peskov isn't the only one questioning these links. There was a joint report from multiple U.S. intelligence agencies, and they found, quote, available intelligence consistently points against the involvement of U.S. adversaries in causing the reported incidents. So how do you square that with what you've heard from the people who say they've been victims?
Yes, yeah, so we spoke with the people who participated in writing this report, and what they answered us is that, like, guys, we don't say, we know that there was nothing. We just say that we didn't find anything. So we did find lots of information that they were not aware of. So it just means that they need to make a new official investigation and include all the things that we found about this GRU unit, also about all of these documents, about the researchers in GRU of this weapon, et cetera, et cetera.
And if you're right, how worried should U.S. and other diplomats be when they go abroad?
Well, they already are very worried. We know that American diplomats, many of them just don't want to go abroad because they are afraid of this repeating. By the way, it's not only going abroad. We have some people, like including some FBI agents and others, who claim that they were actually victims of these kind of attacks on American soil. So, yes, I think that it is like 10 years after it started, it's a damn good time to be worried about like hostile country that actually is already waging a war against the West on Ukrainian soil. Like, I mean, Vladimir Putin and others said that we waging this war not against Ukraine, but against NATO. So they are already saying to Russian population that we are in war with America. But it looks like that America is not noticing this war that is already happening.
Roman, thank you so much for this.
Thank you for having me.
Roman Dobrokhotov is the editor-in-chief of The Insider. He asked that we not disclose his exact location for security reasons. Around the world, hundreds of millions of people speak English. But between variations in dialect and variations in accent, we still sometimes need subtitles to understand one another. And yet, in two places separated by an ocean, there is common linguistic ground. Whitney McCullough is an office manager in Northern Ireland. In her spare time, she makes TikTok videos explaining her slang. And she's found that people as nearby as London might have trouble understanding her. But recently, to her surprise, she learned that people in Newfoundland and Labrador have no problem at all. We reached Whitney McCullough in Banbridge, Northern Ireland.
Whitney, can you give me an example of a bit of language that might get confused looks outside of both where you live and, as you've just discovered, Newfoundland?
Where do you want me to start? There's so many. Something simple would be saying that you've had a scoff or you're going for a feed, which means you're going for your dinner. You know, you're going to go and eat your tea.
Ah.
Another one is dear. So D-E-A-R.
Oh, yeah.
Is used to describe something that's expensive.
So how did you find out that people in Newfoundland could understand you?
Really, really randomly. So there was a new chicken place was opening in Northern Ireland, and it was advertised just on our local news outlets that it was from Canada, and it was branching out of Canada for the first time, and it was randomly coming to Lisburn in Northern Ireland, which isn't far from where I live, about 20-minute drive. And I was like, oh, I'll have to go and try that. But Then I got an invite to have like a lunch party the day before it was officially opening. So normally I don't do those kinds of things. Like I'm not an influencer or anything like that, and I tend to avoid those things. But I had planned on going anyway, so I may as well have went if it was free. So I put a post on TikTok just asking, has anybody heard of Mary Brown's? Does anybody know what Mary Brown's is? You know, they're opening, you know, can anybody tell me anything about it? And the floodgates just seemed to open. And I'd noticed that some of the comments were expressions and words that we would say here, that you wouldn't even get, like as I explained in the interview, I would travel to London quite a bit and forget myself, and I would just speak the way I normally speak, and people would look at you like you've got 10 heads, but here's these people in Canada that know exactly what I'm saying. And then because I already do slang videos from Northern Ireland, they were actually starting to comment on those videos and say, we say that too. You need to check out our dictionary, you know, that you need to take a look. So that's what I've been doing. So in the spare time, if I'm sitting in the evening, so I'll click it back on just on my phone and I'll read through it. And it's crazy the amount of words that are similar. And it all started because of Mary Brown's chicken.
Well, Mary Brown's, I mean, is a big deal in Newfoundland. So how was it?
Oh, it's great. It's good. Funny, I see they're opening a second one here. So it must be doing really, really well. I hope it is.
So something that I find really interesting is that this link is special and unique for another reason. And this comes from Gerard Van Herk, a retired linguistics professor. He told the Canadian Press that the language similarity between Northern Ireland and Newfoundland is intriguing because more people from the south of Ireland would have immigrated to Newfoundland. So why do you think there's so much overlap with Northern Ireland?
Yeah, because some of the words aren't that we share aren't used in the south of Ireland. Yeah, and it's basically a Northern Ireland thing. But what I have found is a lot of people in the comments are saying that some of their family come from Northern Ireland. Some of them emigrated over from Scotland. And what you'll find actually with a lot of the Northern Irish slang is that it's actually called Ulster Scots. And it's a combination of people that emigrated from Scotland over to Northern Ireland and then Ireland and all that. So it seems to be just a mix of people from moving over from years ago from Scotland, Northern Ireland and Ireland. Although in saying that, I do check the dictionary, and there are words that I don't use and we don't use here, and I have to read the explanation on them, that might be possibly used in the south of Ireland.
But it does seem like there is this special link. There's so many words that, you know, you're finding that people are using in Northern Ireland, they're only using in Newfoundland. It seems like a real unique and special connection. How does it feel to have made that discovery?
Oh, it's cool. Oh, I love it. And that's funny. I was saying, you know, people have been so nice. And that's the thing about it, that you know what the internet's like. People can be crazy on the internet. But it just so happens everybody that has been on has been so lovely. And they're sending me recommendations and telling me stuff to look up, and I'm doing videos to tell them what we're doing. So it's great. Like, I'm only on TikTok for fun. You know, I have a full-time job, and that's the way I want it to stay. So the fact that I'm there for fun, and this is fun, you know, it's honestly great.
And now that you've got this link, any plans to visit Newfoundland now?
That is, apparently I am ordered, and strict orders that I have to make it over at some point. Hopefully someday I'll be over. I don't think it's so straightforward just to hop on a flight and land directly, so I would have to check all that out. But someday I will definitely go, and at least to know when I'm there, I'll be able to understand everybody.
Well, Whitney, I watched some of your TikTok videos so I could find some of the slang that is in common between both places. And one of the things that you said was the word awful gets used to mean something good.
Yeah.
Whitney, this has been an awful great chat. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And thank you for getting in touch. And hello to everybody across the water.
Whitney McCullough is an office manager and a TikToker. We reached her in Banbridge, Northern Ireland.
Oh,
That's video from the end of the 2013 Boat Race, an annual rowing competition between Cambridge and Oxford on the River Thames. And you just heard the post-race tradition when the winning team tosses their cocks into the Thames. Instant clarification, that's cocks as in C-O-X, as in person who yells at the other people in the boat to go faster. Anyway, Cambridge cocks Ed Bracey said he was fine with going in the river this past Saturday after his team won, but his coach nixed it. I know he would like to, he said, but we don't want to risk it. Traditionalists probably spat their tea out when they heard that. Don't want to risk it. Cor blimey, they probably scoffed, choking on their crustless cucumber sandwiches. You must be taking the mickey, and so forth, with other British expressions of disgust. But their disgust cannot match the disgust of everyone who had to spend any time recently on or in the Thames. Lenny Jenkins is one of those people. He rows for the losing Oxford men's team, three members of which had a stomach bug before the race. He was magnanimous in defeat, praising Cambridge's team, but he added this.
My shoulders, but yeah, it would have been ideal not to have so much poo in the water, but
that is something we can all agree on. It really would have been ideal not to have so much poo in the water. Before the race, research indicated high levels of E. coli in the Thames due to the billions of liters of untreated sewage that have been discharged into the river, and all the teams trained on the Thames for weeks before the boat race. That storied race is supposed to determine who's better at rowing, not who's more resistant to intestinal bacteria. So obviously it's time to clean up the Thames, and that is more than a gut reaction.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone knows that it's the people who make a community what it is. But in Pine Mountain Club, California, it's also the bears, and that is not a good thing. The small mountain community north of Los Angeles is seeing a stark rise in the number of bear sightings and break-ins. According to officials, they're receiving hundreds more calls for assistance this year than they did last year. Jennifer Emmett is a resident of Pine Mountain Club, California. We reached her today in Crescent Springs, Kentucky.
Jennifer, if I came to visit Pine Mountain Club, what are the chances I'd see a bear?
Well, seeing a bear and then finding out about a bear are two different things. I rarely see any bears around my house, more of how often do they break into houses, which is the bigger issue.
Yeah, can you tell me a little more about that? Because I understand you have a bit more experience than you'd like with these bears. What's happened to you?
That's right. I was only there about a year and a half. And I had read a lot about it. You have to make sure that your cars are locked, your windows are rolled up, you don't leave your house open. So I had been following all of those rules, but apparently I missed the part about putting curtains on your window so the bears can't see in. So he saw a baker's rack in my lower storage area, I guess it would kind of be called at the time, and literally bent the frame of the window and the window came crashing down. I heard a noise. Well, it didn't come back. So I went to do my normal workday, which is downstairs. And I put down a cup of coffee and went back upstairs to grab a load of laundry. And when I came back downstairs to go into my little storage area, I saw the rear end of a bear go out the window.
Oh, wow. When you saw that bear going out the window, what was your reaction?
I screamed and dropped the laundry basket. And I literally blacked out for a moment because I ran upstairs apparently and grabbed some noisemakers and went outside to go chase the bear away. And when I came out of my blackout, I had an air horn in my hand and I was yelling, "Go bear, go bear." And finally, after I was throwing a few rocks at it, it finished jumping over the fence.
What about your neighbors? Have you heard other stories like this?
We've recently had several bears breaking into houses, primarily uninhabited houses. We have a lot of vacation properties. So quite often the bears will look for houses that are empty. And they have been recently breaking into several houses in the area.
Mm. It seems that break-ins and bear-human encounters like this are on the rise. The local patrol office there says they received 563 calls for wildlife assistance last year. That's compared to 319 the year before. Community members are saying that more than 300 homes and sheds were broken into and 179 vehicles. What do you think is driving this increase?
A couple things. We believe there's a few bear feeders, so that makes the bears more habituated to people and less afraid of humans when they come around. We also have a couple mother bears who have been teaching their baby bears how to break into houses. So therefore, those bears are growing up and become a nuisance bear as well.
Well, the Los Angeles Times spoke to one of your neighbors, James Weinstock, who says that he supports feeding the bears, including two that he's nicknamed Cinnamon and Blackie. He describes them as two big puppy dogs. What do you make of his approach?
Well, I think it's very dangerous. And he found out at the same time that it can be dangerous since they came in the house and took swipes at him and sent him to the hospital. So no, I don't agree with that methodology. I think they need to be afraid of people. I think they need to look at a human and run from a human. So most of the community has approached bears with the scare them away tactic. You know, as soon as you see it, shoo it away.
How overwhelming is it for you and others to have so many bears in your community?
As I mentioned, I don't leave my front doors open. I also have a couple dogs, so they're very good at hearing animals in the yard and they bark. So during the day, I typically will know if there's a bear in the area.
Mm. It's remarkable to me that you say that you're not scared of them. I would be scared. It sounds like you've just learned how to live with this. Do you think that's what people in Pine Mountain Club are just going to have to do?
I think so. I think just locking the doors, locking cars, don't leave windows open in the cars, don't leave windows in rooms unattended. There's a good chance if you're cooking with the windows open, the bear is going to approach the house. Some people turn up the radio loud to talk radio while they're cooking or doing anything that might attract a bear. We also make sure we close windows when we get done, wash our dishes as soon as we finish, because the bears are just looking for an opportunity to break in. If you don't give them the opportunity, they won't break in.
What are you going to do if this problem gets worse? Will you stay?
That's a good question. A few people have left. I've heard of several vacation homeowners have packed up and left. And some people even that lived here had no idea how bad the bear problem was. But since I don't have that many run-ins with them, I guess if I had a house where they were constantly running around the house and breaking into my neighbors' houses, fortunately, I'm not in that area where they're having the most break-ins right now. I guess my plan is to continue to be aware and be very cognizant of the fact that I'm living in their neighborhood.
Jennifer, good luck with it. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking me to join.
Jennifer Emmett is a resident of Pine Mountain Club, California, but today we reached her in Crescent Springs, Kentucky. Canada's youngest territory is 25 years old today. Nunavut, which means our land in Inuktitut, officially became part of the map of Canada on April 1st, 1999. Its formation was part of a historic land claim settlement. On that day, there were festivities across the new territory. As it happens, spoke to people in several spots in the sprawling region, including CBC reporter Lisa Ipili, who was at the ceremony in Iqaluit.
Lisa, there's a celebration going on behind you there. What's going on? That's right. The Premier, Paul Okeluf of Nunavut, is just talking at the first sitting of the Nunavut Legislative Assembly here in Iqaluit at the Inukshuk High School. And it's quite appropriate because when they were here in 1993, when then Prime Minister Brian Mulroney signed the land claims, final land claims agreement, everybody is here, all the MLAs and invited guests, John Chrétien, our Prime Minister, and Honorable Minister for Diane is here as well, and invited elders from all over Nunavut, and there are RCMP from all over Nunavut as well here. Jane Stewart is sitting next to Jean Chrétien and occasionally nodding as Premier Paul Okeluf is talking. Quite an exciting time right now at the Inukshuk High School here in Iqaluit.
Yeah, Iqaluit is just bursting at the seams with people to observe this exciting day, huh?
It's just enormously frantic time right now. For the taxis are busy all the time. You have to wait 1 hour, perhaps to 45 minutes to wait for a taxi. The people with the overflow, the buses in town that we have, and they aren't too many, are being fully utilized, and the hotels and everybody who has private housing that could fill up people with bunks or cots or sleeping mattresses are taking in people. Just a massive number of people here. It's just totally filled. Yeah.
Are the residents just bursting with happiness and pride?
I think there is a strong mix of feelings right now. There is a very big sense of pride and a sense of ownership that's going to probably start from this day, April 1. It's a new beginning, as a lot of elders have saying, look to your future, set your goals, realize your dreams. This seems to be an overwhelming theme from last night's church service and fireworks to today's speeches. It's quite an emotional moment for a lot of people. I've seen people who are literally crying and very emotional, and some people just with hands up in the air.
Lisa, we'll let you get back to the ceremony. Thank you so much.
Taima and Tapavusi, Canada Mute, thank you very much. Nakome.
Taima.
Bye-bye.
CBC reporter Lisa Ipili speaking with former As It Happens host Mary Lou Finley 25 years ago today. Do you ever find yourself staring into the eyes of your furry, drooling companion and wondering, what's going on in there? Well, now scientists have an answer, and it's probably more than you'd think. Researchers in Hungary measured the brain waves of 18 dogs. They played an audio clip in which they said the name of a dog toy and then showed the dog an object. If the object didn't match the word said in the clip, the dog's brains would register surprise. The conclusion, dogs are actually forming a mental image of an object after hearing their owners say it. Of course, the owner of Chaser could have told you all of that without any brain scans. John W. Pelley of South Carolina trained Chaser the Border Collie to understand more than 1,000 nouns. Chaser died in 2019, and on that sad occasion, As It Happens, guest host Rosemary Barton spoke with Pelley Bianchi, John W. Pelley's daughter. Here's part of that interview from our archives.
Pelley Bianchi, let me start by saying I'm so sorry for the loss of your family's dog, Chaser.
Oh, thank you, Rosemary. It was a big one.
She was a special dog.
Oh, yes. Extraordinary.
She does have the title sort of as the smartest dog in the world. How smart was she?
Well, she was able to manipulate and get her way on a daily basis. But what garnered her international fame is that she had the largest language learning of any animal based on her formal language learning.
Incredible. So this was work that your father, John Pelley, who died last year, did with her. How did he manage to teach Chaser 1,000 words?
Well, with a lot of dogged persistence. That's who my father was. But it was all through play. He got Chaser as a 2-month-old border collie with the goal of teaching her human language. And any language, you need a vocabulary. So her vocabulary was going to be her toys. And he started teaching her at 8 weeks through a process called errorless learning, and proceeded to teach her the new name of a toy every 3 days. And by the time she was 5 months old, she had that aha moment. Ah, words, words have meaning. When he's holding up this toy, it means this is the name of that toy.
Can you give listeners a sense of some of those words?
Well, they vary between blue to Franklin, circle. They were toys that we probably all knew, but my father gave them very odd names. For instance, she had a SpongeBob, but that wasn't his name. He named SpongeBob something that could have been Flippity Flop. And it was good because she could remember the names, but we had to write them down.
What was it like for you when you first saw what Chaser was able to do?
I was kind of blown away. I mean, I knew what he was doing with her, but until the research was published, I really did not understand the gravitas that this was. And also, what a lot of people don't know about Chaser is that she is not an obedient dog.
What do you mean?
Well, she knows the obedience commands, you know, sit, stay, walk, no, yes. But what my father wanted to do was teach her a concept instead of rote behavior, so that gave her a lot of leeway and freedom.
She was almost more independent than a normal dog.
Oh, gosh, she was so independent.
What was your dad trying to show from a science and research perspective? What was he trying to demonstrate?
Well, he was trying to demonstrate that animals could learn human language. No one had tried to teach, interact with canines in a meaningful way to learn human language. Lewis Herman was working with the dolphins. We had research in the primate area, but the dog was uncharted territory. And he firmly believed, especially in working with his previous dogs, that dogs were way smarter than the world has believed them to be. And he wanted to find out the boundaries of the canine mind.
So I watched a video of your dad and Chaser with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and not only was Chaser able to identify the toys that he named, but she was also able to logically deduce what object was new, even though she had never seen it before. I mean, that's incredible.
It's stunning. The first time I witnessed her do that, it took my breath away. That's learning by inference, and it's called fast mapping, and it is how children learn.
Hmm. Do you think any dog could do this, or was Chaser just, you know, an out-of-this-world kind of dog?
No, my father strongly believed that she was not unique. It's the way that she was taught that's unique. And what he did was he channeled her innate instinct to herd and chase objects, and he used that, integrating that with play, into learning the names of words.
Did she have a favorite word?
Oh, it was ball. Blue ball.
True to her doggy soul, I guess.
Yes. That was her most favorite object in the whole world.
Your dad died last year. How was that for her?
That's a good question. And the reality of it was, Chaser, she was not a touchy-feely dog. But when we brought her to hospice, 5-6 days before he passed, she would come into his outreached arms and she would, you know, allow herself to be pet. But most of the time she wandered into the other room to sort of engage with other people. But it was hours before his death that she planted herself firmly in front of his bed with her head down, her shoulders square, giving him that border collie eye, and gave one very loud, sharp bark. And it gave us goosebumps because we knew that she was not beckoning him to wake up. She was bidding him goodbye. Hmm. It was stunning.
Well, I know you think that every dog could do this, but just watching some videos of Chaser, I think she was pretty special. So again, so sorry for your loss and your family's loss.
Thank you, Rosemary.
Nice to speak with you.
You as well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
From our archives, that was As It Happens guest host Rosemary Barton talking to Pilly Bianchi, the daughter of John W. Pilly, who taught his dog to understand more than 1,000 nouns. On this day, 75 years ago, people in Newfoundland and Labrador woke up Canadian for the first time. The province officially joined Confederation on March 31st, 1949, and the debate over doing that was tense, and the decision to do it was tight, with just 52% of the population voting in favor of the move in a referendum. 10 years on, the province's first premier, Joey Smallwood, stood by his push for the move.
In the end, we'll all be intensely proud to be Canadians. That 10 years from tonight, there'll be less uncertainty than there is tonight. I hope that 10 years from tonight, that no one in Newfoundland will have any reason to doubt the wisdom and the success of Confederation. Thank you very much.
From 1959, that was former Newfoundland and Labrador Premier Joey Smallwood. Now, as you heard, Mr. Smallwood's hope then was that Confederation would be widely considered a success. But for Mi'kmaq elder Calvin White, that is not the lasting impression, because the terms of union with Canada did not mention the province's Indigenous people.
I suspect it had to be deliberate, because in 1945, 218 people in this little community right here identified themselves as First Nation people. Therefore, the authorities responsible in the negotiation was very much aware. Apart from that, even in the 1921 census, there were families on the island of Newfoundland as far back as then who had identified themselves as Mi'kmaq people. Looking at the history of Canada, of the government of Canada, going back to the doctrine of discovery, the government always tried to either assimilate or eradicate Aboriginal populations. Why Joey Smallwood would have suggested that there are no Aboriginal people on the island of Newfoundland, that's a question that we'll never get the answer for. We never know what was his motive for doing it. But I'm sure that the federal government didn't insist that we should look at any census or any other information, because it was right up their agenda of not having to deal with Aboriginal people.
What did that omission from the terms of union mean for you as an adult starting out embarking on the struggle for Indigenous rights?
It was, it offered one of the greatest challenges that I could ever think about that I would have in a lifetime, because by then what you had is you had the information that supported total denial.
What does Confederation, the anniversary of Confederation now, being part of Canada, mean for Mi'kmaq people today?
I don't know what it means for every Mi'kmaq person. I wouldn't want to try to answer that question for other people. But for me, I can tell you what it means. There's nothing really for me to celebrate. There's nothing for me to be excited about. We still have unfinished business. We have a lot of healing, but we have a lot of work to do before we can consider ourselves to be Canadians, if Canadian means that you're supposed to be administered all of the rights and privileges associated with the Constitution of Canada.
Calvin White is a Mi'kmaq elder in Flat Bay, Newfoundland and Labrador. He was talking to the CBC's Bernice Hillier. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1, following Your World Tonight.
You can also listen to the show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app. Thanks for listening. I'm Stephanie Skanderas.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.